Hello, and welcome back for another affiliate-focused branch of the UF Care Podcast, conversations with early career professionals studying addiction research here at the University of Florida, as well as providing advice and support for those entering the field. My name is Victor. I am a first-year grad student here at the Department of Clinical Health Psychology, working with Dr. Jeff Boisneau. And today we are talking with Julianne Price. Hi, Julianne.
Hi, Victor. How's it going?
It's going well today. How are you?
Great.
Good. Julianne is a graduate student here who has, in the last 5 years, been working towards and recently completed a PhD in behavioral cognitive neuroscience. And fun fact, I saw on Twitter that you used the hashtag social isolation dissertation,
which I thought
was very clever, and hashtag PhDone.
PhDone.
Which I think summarizes that emotion just so succinctly.
I don't think I was prepared for how emotional defending would be. You know, you look forward to it for 5 years at least, and you plan for it, you practice, and then the moment it happens, it just, it's just a release. It is cathartic.
I can really only imagine. I mean, we've all had milestones in our lives, finishing school to different degrees, high school or undergrad, different, like even younger things like moving from preschool to kindergarten, for example. But getting that PhD done seems like such a buildup of mental energy over the span of these years.
It really is. It flies by. The defense, it was about an hour and a half long, and it happened so quickly in my mind that I was like, that's it. That's 5 years of work, and it's done so fast.
You can condense it so much.
Yeah. it was exhausting, but wonderful.
Well, big congratulations for that. That is huge and terribly exciting. Yeah. So that is one of the things that I want to talk with you about today, but some other things. We're just going to be talking a bit about your research and how you got into the line of research that you're doing. And now that you've done your dissertation, what comes next in your career? And then we'll wrap up at the end with some advice for other early career professionals who want to follow in your footsteps in the future.
Very cool. Yeah.
Cool. So first, can you tell us a little bit about what your dissertation was?
Yeah. So if we talk a bit about my history, you'll see that my original research interest was in the HPA axis, or one of the body's stress response systems that releases cortisol. And I took that interest and kind of mix and mingled with my new work from the neurocognitive lab. So in individuals that have alcohol use disorder, the stress hormone cortisol is much, much higher when they're drinking. And then once they decide to enter treatment or quit drinking, those cortisol levels almost skyrocket. They go even higher up. However, after they've been sober or abstinent from alcohol for a matter of weeks, those levels drop. And they drop not just to back to normal, but even below that.
It's like a withdrawal response.
Mm-hmm. Kind of it was argued to be a correction, but it seems from the past years of research that it might be more of a maladaptive drop.
Huh.
And there have been research groups that have used cortisol measures in treatment to predict relapse severity, completion of treatment, whether you leave before your timeline is up or not. And it seems that these cortisol levels across time, when it's high when you're drinking, high when you go through withdrawal, low in abstinence, each of those time points is important. They each contribute to the story. But it's, until recently, has been almost near impossible to collect all of those time points in one person. You know, are you going to go out into the community, find somebody who appears to have an alcohol use disorder, collect their cortisol, and then follow them until they decide they're ready for treatment? You know, how are you going to chase them?
Right. really engineer that very well.
Yeah. And so what we did is we actually have people who have been in treatment for about 4 to 6 weeks, And we cut their a chunk of their hair. It's a small piece of hair, about half of a pencil width, and
width, not length.
Right, the full length, however much is there, but but the width is just a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And but then when you segment it, so your hair grows about a centimeter a month. So if we take that centimeter of hair that's closest to the scalp, and that's going to be your cortisol from last month. You then take the next centimeter out, that's the cortisol from 2 months ago, and so on and so forth. And so you can kind of create this monthly calendar up to about 6 months before it starts to degrade in the hair, that you can look at their cortisol levels month by month by month. So what we did was we collected these hair samples from people who had been in treatment for a little over a month and then segmented their hair. So now we have cortisol from when they're in treatment, cortisol from when they entered treatment or experienced withdrawal, and then cortisol back months to when they were drinking.
And so this was really cool. That's clever.
Yeah. So this was the first time, you know, anybody who's really been able to use any sort of retrospective biomarker that you can look back in time before somebody even considered going to treatment.
Right. Before they even stopped, you can get this information.
Yeah. So we first established that as a possible research method in this population, since it hasn't been done. And it was actually pretty easy. I was surprised how many people were willing to let me, a random person, come cut their hair.
Was part of the study, or did you just go on the street and ask around?
Just started asking who was willing.
We need this much hair. We'll cover it up.
But yeah, walking into a treatment facility with like a box of barber supplies, you know, you've got cleaning, you've got hair shears, combs, and tape measures. And I was surprised how many people were willing to let me cut their hair. It's a very vulnerable feeling having somebody you don't know cut a chunk of your hair out.
I can imagine. It's a very intimate, sort of close relationship that you develop with your hairstylist or your barber. And I guess you got that as a researcher in this case.
Yeah, I realized. So we, of course, you know, in all research techniques, you practice before you start the study. Mm-hmm. You, if it's a computer task, you practice it. If it's a method, you work on each other. So the other researchers in my lab, our lab, we practiced cutting each other's hair before going to the facility. And I didn't realize it was when one of the RAs cut my hair, I was like, I'm really mad at you right now. I'm more attached to my hair than I realized.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you've had it for however many months. I suppose it also depends on the length of your hair a little bit and how much you take care of it. Because as a guy, I've had shorter hair most of my life, and so it's getting cut pretty frequently, pretty far down. But for someone who's grown out their hair longer, you know, I can imagine you develop that closeness to it, and then choosing to sacrifice it for this kind of research, that's an experience right there.
It is. I did have a couple of research participants after the fact have the kind of the same response that I did, where they're like, I was okay with this, but I'm a little mad at you right now. So it became a kind of a running joke how much people love their hair. You have very lush hair. I feel like you would probably feel the same way, it looks like.
Thank you. My hair is longer than I usually like to let it grow because we're all socially isolating for the virus. This is recorded in April of 2020. So it's a little longer than normal. And I wonder with my eventual barber, you know, sometime in the future, will I have that sort of bittersweet moment where, yeah, the hair is gone, but at what cost? So I wanted to ask, that technique of cutting the hair to get the cortisol is really interesting. It sounds novel for this case. How do you get that data from the hair? What do you do with it? Is there a chemical bath that you submerse it in, you take a reading?
Mm-hmm. So I was not the one who did the immunoassaying of the hair, but yes, it was our collaborator, Clemens Kirschbaum, who's actually in Dresden, Germany. And you segment it into the centimeter sections, and then you process each one separately. And it's just a typical, you might not want to air this part because I think I'm going to mispronounce it, chemiluminescent immunoassay.
All the parts of that sound right to me.
If I said it right, you can keep it. I'm not sure if I did or not. Yeah, chemiluminescent immunoassaying. It's just the typical procedure for extracting cortisol. Or
usually people just use an acronym.
Yeah, CLIA.
Okay.
Immunoassaying of cortisol. It's just the typical procedure.
Mm-hmm. So what did you find?
So we, you know, to be honest, I actually really like when my research is not what I expected. I actually get really excited when my findings are the exact opposite, because I like when it surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually at first almost disappointed because it was not surprising. It was consistent with all the literature, but in a feasibility study like this, you really want it to be. So we found that in these kind of further out, these more distal segments of hair, the cortisol was significantly higher than when they were in treatment. So you do see these elevations in the three segments out, two segments out, but that segment of hair closest to the scalp, that's the most recent month when they were abstinent, is significantly lower. We also actually used it as a correlate of cognitive recovery. So these same participants in my study were also doing a cognitive study that we were running as well. So they did some cognitive testing when they first came into treatment and some cognitive testing when they left treatment. And the shape of their cortisol curve, how high it was and how low it dropped, was predictive of their cognitive recovery. So people who had this significant drop, these substantially lower levels, actually did worse in the end. So it's kind of supporting the hypothesis that this is an overcorrection, that this is maladaptive.
Sure. Huh. I don't know quite what to make of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So there's been some researchers who have looked at elevating cortisol in people in treatment, so stopping mm-hmm. that drop from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had mild success. However, it seems like these earlier pieces, how high it is when they're drinking, when they go through withdrawal, are important aspects too. So maybe it's the combination across these months that's important, maybe intervening when the cortisol is high as opposed to when it is low
mm-hmm.
so would better target it.
So this could point to an intervention of the cortisol levels, artificially mm-hmm. Adjusting higher or lower to mm-hmm. prevent the sort of mental associations with that withdrawal decline in cortisol.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah. It was exciting. It was exciting data. I was really stoked to present it.
Absolutely. It sounds neat.
Yeah.
It's a novel process that finds greater veracity into what we already knew, but presents it in a way that is exciting and raises some different possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really neat.
Yeah.
So can you go into a little bit more detail as to how you got into this work? I know you mentioned a little bit earlier about the experience in finding this lab, mm-hmm. but could you go into like undergrad experience? Did you expect going into that, this is where you would end up?
Absolutely not. this is not the road I ever thought I would take. Research in general, I think like many undergrad psychology majors, I pictured clinical psychology. I pictured working with clients. And my senior year of college, a double major in psychology and criminology. So I was actually really interested in forensic psych.
Oh, cool.
So I had originally thought about working in the criminal justice system, being a clinical psychologist for police officers who have experienced trauma, or working within a prison system for people to take the stand in their own defense. So my senior year of college, I interned at a prison, and it was as exciting as I thought it would be. It was a really cool experience. And there was one day that the psychologist I was shadowing invited me to night court. It was called Divert. And it was a diversion program where people who are in jail for nonviolent felony drug offenses could, as opposed to serving their sentence, participate in this, I think it was 18-month long treatment program. And as long as they abided by the rules and provided negative urine drug screens throughout the process, their drug charges would be expunged from their record. No prison time, no parole, no probation, nothing like that. I'm sorry, you can probably hear the baby in the background.
It's okay.
Yelling. And they had something insane, like a 90% success rate, that these people stayed abstinent for years out. And that's huge.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started participating in this night court, and I just really got interested into the substance use aspect of incarceration. So I met with a doctor who did substance use research, and really just out of interest, still thinking I was going to end up clinical, and I just fell in love with research. I love the process. I love testing a hypothesis and for just a small moment in time, knowing something that nobody else knows, and then being able to share that with people. I got excited by it. And so I stuck with research from there on out.
It's always interesting to hear folks' stories. It's rarely that what they thought going in is where they end up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I feel like we build these notions of what our lives are going to look like based off incomplete data because we haven't lived it yet.
Yeah.
And then once we do and we're able to fill in the gaps and adjust our own like personal lifestyle hypotheses, we can better understand, oh yeah, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. So Julianne, what is next? You've presented your dissertation. Everything is fine and dandy with the world.
Sure.
What's your plan moving forward?
I don't think I've mentioned yet, my husband, and there's a baby in the other room that is probably yelling in the background that you might not be able to edit out. My husband is also a researcher. We met at UF through our graduate program. We both have actually secured postdocs at Rutgers University. So while I see my U-Haul boxes in the background,
I can see them.
Yeah, we're packing up the house right now. So amongst all this pandemic fun, we're in the middle of moving across the country.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We'll both be on a new T32 for molecular neuroscience of alcohol and drug abuse research training, MNA DART. So I'll be working with Marcia Bates and Jen Buckman, who I've known for a while now, integrating this hair work with the cognitive aspect of it into their main focus, which is cardiovascular function and biofeedback.
Excellent. Just adding it on.
Yeah, just
keeping on building it. That's great. Yeah. When does that start?
In about 3 weeks.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Wild time, right?
Yeah.
It's so much happening at once for you.
2020 is a weird time.
Right.
2020 is out of this world.
Absolutely. We'll get through it. We'll get through it.
Yeah.
Okay. I asked you how you got here. I asked where you're going. Do you have any words of advice for others who are interested in this kind of research, in addiction research, in cortisol markers, or even the methods that you're using, of looking at the hair and working with these different populations? Any advice for people who are just starting their own journey?
I think along the way, both there are going to be times where you're going to become discouraged in yourself, in the process, in the world of addiction research. I have found times where I sit here and I look at my research and I think, why does this matter? Is this really important? I look at my career trajectory and I think, what am I doing? Where am I going? Like, get your head on straight. And it's so easy to get discouraged in this world. And that's okay. I'm not saying don't, but roll with it. Don't stay in that moment, because the next thing is going to be great. And it's hard. You know, it's the PhD is hard. Research is hard. Especially if you're doing the clinical aspect of this, working with individuals in treatment is hard. You know, you walk into a treatment facility and you see somebody there who you've given money to on the street. You see someone there who was in your treatment study 2 years ago, and now they're back here again. And it's really easy just to look at that and become discouraged with the world. But, you know, I think all aspects of addiction research are building to something great, that you really need to keep in mind that your work is a small piece of the puzzle, and that puzzle is becoming more complete because of you.
Thank you, Dr. Price.
Doctor.
We also want to give a thanks to the University of Florida Center for Addiction Research and Education, Dr. Oliver Grundman, Dr. Sarah Jo Nixon, Dr. Joanne Paris, and all of our mentors and future collaborators. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.